We're going to discuss today a number of different questions that came up recently. They were addressed by Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein Shlita. And in Mirtz Hashem, I hope we'll have time for a question that was addressed by Rav Herschel Schechter. The first question, which if you happen to have the text, you can find it on page 17. If not, I'll present it Baal Peh. We have a principle called Grama bin Ezekin. And what this means is that I cause you a financial loss. And what Rav Zilberstein wants to study in this particular presentation is the possibility that Corona might actually change the status of Grama bin Ezekin, when I cause you an indirect loss. And this is going to come up in a few different cases. One case we'll start with now, and that's a case where Yehuda, as we call him just for a name, tried to make peace between Reuven and Shimon. And the story, as he presents it, is very reminiscent of a famous Gemara in Masechta Gittin. He doesn't mention this Gemara, of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. You're all familiar with that Gemara. It's something that we study on Tisha B'Av, and it's one of the causes of the Churban HaBayis. In this case, Yehuda has two buddies. He has two friends, Reuven and Shimon. And these three musketeers, if we could call them that, had a long-time friendship that goes back many years. But unfortunately, Reuven and Shimon had some sort of misunderstanding, an altercation, and it severed their relationship. And this bothered Yehuda tremendously. He wanted to always think if there's a way, perhaps, that he could make peace between Reuven and Shimon. As it turns out, Reuven is marrying off his daughter. And Yehuda, who's still in very good friendship with Reuven, receives an invitation. I'm not sure exactly how Reuven was able to do this, Yehuda was able to do this. Yehuda, again, still has a good relationship with Reuven. He receives this invitation, and somehow he was able to send this invitation, to forward it to Shimon, without Shimon realizing that this invitation really was just passed on to him by Yehuda. Shimon innocently, naively believed that it was Reuven who was inviting him, Shimon, to Reuven's daughter's wedding. Maybe he switched the envelope, or maybe it came, you know, today everything is by electronic mail, so it doesn't have your name on it. And Yehuda was able to send on this invitation to Shimon without Shimon realizing that it was Yehuda behind the scenes. Shimon receives this invitation to Reuven's daughter's wedding, thinking that this is finally the opportunity to recreate the friendship. What Shimon was unaware of was that although he, Shimon, desperately wanted to re-establish that close friendship with Reuven, it was not reciprocal. But Yehuda figured that maybe if Shimon would actually show up at this wedding, and especially during difficult times, Reuven would melt, he would break down, and they'd be able to re-establish the friendship. Unfortunately, with all due respect, and again, Yehuda had great interests in mind, it didn't work that way. Shimon, thinking he was inviting to the wedding, writes out a check for 1,000 shekel. This is an opportunity to recreate an old friendship. He thinks, I'm going to go all out and give an unusually high gift for this wedding. And, of course, he puts it into the box as he enters into the wedding. Unfortunately, as Shimon enters into the wedding, all he gets from Reuven is a cold shoulder. And it appears to Shimon that Reuven, in fact, did not invite him. It was Shimon who had, it was Yehuda, as we said, who had made this decision. Now, the way that the story evolves is that Shimon gets back from this wedding and he gets on the phone to Yehuda to tell Yehuda what tsar, how much suffering he feels. He had so much hope that with this wedding Shimon would be able to reestablish the friendship. And he tells Yehuda about this expensive gift that he gave to Reuven, and that despite it all, Reuven was not willing, as we say in Hebrew, lehit payes, you know, to be pacified and to reestablish the friendship. At this point, Yehuda is very depressed. He realizes that he messed up bad. There was a boo-boo on his part, that although his initiative was done for the right purposes, his heart was certainly in the right place, but that no way would Shimon have showed up at this wedding if not for his intervention, Yehuda's intervention. And not only that, certainly Shimon would not have given a gift of that very expensive price. And the question is whether or not Yehuda has to reimburse Shimon, besides having to ask him for mechila. But is this a loss that, as the laws of compensation and damages would require Yehuda to reimburse Shimon for the loss? We'll get to Corona in just a minute, because again, this story could have happened at any time. Rav Zilberstein opens his tshuva by quoting a machlokes between the Nesivos, who Rav Yaakov Elisa lived about 170 years ago, no more, even 200 years ago, and some of the other poskim. The Nesivos has a breakthrough ruling that in Nezikin, Adam Muad Li Olam, a man who causes damages to someone else, is guilty even if he had the right intention in mind. The Kavana Letova is not Mafkia, it doesn't uproot the status of the Maisa Hezek, and therefore he has to pay. And the Nesivos addresses a case where Reuven thought that he was doing a good thing on behalf of Shimon, and he buried Shimon's money deep down in the ground to protect it. And at the end of the day, Reuven, although he was trying to be a good Samaritan, as we'd say, he forgot exactly where the money was buried, and he couldn't find it. And as a result, Shimon took a loss, and the Nesivos paskins that Reuven has to pay. He deliberately took the money of Reuven and buried it. That's a Maisa Hezek. The fact that he was motivated L'Tovas Chavero is irrelevant. He's an absolute Mazik. However, the Makar Chaim, who was a contemporary of the Nesivos, also one of the outstanding poskim in Chol Shem Mishpat, disagrees with the Nesivos, and he says that there's no chi of nezikin in a case where you did something which would have been meaningful under normal conditions and would have protected someone else for loss. Again, it boomeranged back, but that was your intention. And he quotes a very famous Gemara to prove this, which is also codified in Shulchan Aruch, that if a person moves a utensil of his friend from one place to the other and it breaks, then if he moved it for the sake of the utensil, meaning that the utensil was in a precarious situation, that's called litzarka. He didn't move it for his own personal benefit, but for the benefit of the kli, then pot. And the gigantic posek in Chosha Mishra called the Sma, the Sefer Mir, saying Nayim, now we're going back many, many centuries, he accepts this halacha that Hamavir Hametaltel Kli Shel Chaver Mimakom Lemakom Benishpura, if it was Litzarka, meaning for the Tzorech, for the benefit of the Kli, then he's potter, he doesn't have to pay. Our situation, at the face of it, would be very similar to this, because Yehuda took this invitation and he passed it on to Shimon, and that caused Shimon a loss. Yehuda's intentions, as we said over and over again, were positive. And this situation as to whether or not Yehuda should be obligated to reimburse and compensate, whether Yehuda should compensate Shimon for his loss, the 1,000 shekel that he paid for this wedding, and so forth and so on, that should depend upon the machlokas between the Nesivus on the one hand and the Mekor Chaim on the other hand, regarding someone who causes damage to someone with the right intention, when he's motivated for the right intention. However, Rav Zilberstein thinks that in this particular case, even the Nesivus would have to agree that Yehuda is potter. And why is that? Because the Nesivus was addressing a case where Shimon took the money of Reuven and buried it. Or the case of the Mekor Chaim, where he took a kli of his friend and he moved it from one place to the other, thinking that would be helpful. In both of those two cases, we can debate whether there's a chi of nezikin because it was a direct act of mazik. But in our case, did Yehuda, I'm asking this as a rhetorical question, did Yehuda put his hand into Shimon's pocket and destroy an object that was worth 1,000 shekel? At best, you can call him grumma, which is called indirect hezek. However, Rav Zilberstein points out that the Gemara in Bava Kamma, in many different places, says that grumma nezikin potter b'dini adam v'chayav b'din shamayim, which means that although the nizak who suffered the loss has no recourse to sue in a court of law to get his money back, his compensation, but nevertheless, as far as Din Shamayim is concerned, the Nizak has a tviyah, he has a claim against the Mazik, even though the Mazik damaged him indirectly by Grama, and Grama ben Ezekin Chayav ben Din Shamayim. Not only that, but there is a possibility, says Rav Zilberstein, that this would be garmi. Garmi, loosely translated, is a high statistical probability of causing someone an indirect damage. And if you happen to have the text, we're on the top of page 18, in the third paragraph, and he says that yitochen shezeh nechshav ligarmi. Garmi is that gray area between indirect and direct. Sharei Shimon tzipol izdamnut litpayes. Shimon himself was waiting for the opportunity to reestablish his friendship with Reuven. Vaminagu, and it's quite common that the opportune moment to be mitpayez, to reestablish a friendship that was broken, is at a family simcha. When you're marrying off, in this case, your daughter, that's a great opportunity to invite somebody that was your old-time buddy, but you had a broken relationship with. And since, you know, it's an invitation that Shimon really thinks he's getting from Reuven, in that sense, you know, Yehuda is causing almost a direct damage by taking this invitation, which Shimon is looking for in the mail and hoping it comes, and putting it in the mail without asking neither Reuven's permission nor Shimon's permission. However, Yehuda, as we said before, did not evaluate the situation properly. He didn't realize the depth of resentment that Reuven was holding against the grudge of Reuven against Shimon. And Shimon lost 1,000 shekel as a result. Comes along Rav Zilberstein with an amazing chiddush. And again, I always tell you this. Intuitively, I never would have guessed in a million years that there's any way that Shimon could force Yehuda to reimburse him at a court of law, a Jewish court of law. But this happened during Corona. Now, what relevance does Corona have to this situation? He says the following. That there's a great posek back in Turkey. So if you have any friends who are Turkish Jews, you'll ask him about Reb Chaim Palagi, a magnificent posek. He wrote extensively, tshuvas, and he says the following: Yesh lisrachik ma'od ma'od mimachlokes. Bifrat bizman magefa. He says that during a moment of a plague, one has to be very careful not to hold grudges against any creature, because the power of machlokes during a magefa period is very dangerous. And we'll see this in the story of Korach, Vadoso, and many other situations throughout the Tanakh, that during a magefa, as a result of machlokes, the fire of the plague rages on. And therefore, says Reb Chaim Palagi, Mishiyesh lo das, if a person realizes the nature and the danger of a plague situation, but he has any level of intelligence, yivater mishalo. He says he should give up even if he thinks he has a rightful claim against someone. He should waive that claim. V'yotza hefseido bischaro. This is the opposite. We usually say yotza scharo hefseido. Rav Palagi turns it around and he says yotza hefseido bischaro. The schar that he'll get for this hefse that he'll suffer, again, he thinks it's a hefse by giving in to his friend. That schar is great in this world and in the next world. Ki oev shalom v'rodev shalom. This is going to save him at the moment of magefa. And therefore, says Rav Zilberstein, standing on the shoulders of this psak, of this responsa from 100 years before, you know, before the machlokas between the Nesivis and the Makor Chaim, Levavos Hayushvurim, he says that the hearts were broken, everyone was afraid of Corona, and there's no question that Shimon was thinking that he certainly has to do whatever he can in order to protect his life during this magefa period. And he assumes that Reuven likewise would certainly avail himself of this possibility and would invite him to the wedding. This would be a great opportunity to be mevater, to give in to someone else, and protect themselves during a magefa period from machlokes. If this be the case, yitochen, he wants to raise the following possibility, Rav Zilberstein, she'im Yehuda mevin she'shivo mechapes hagona li notzel me'amagefa, hoyamaskim lahefseid, afilu li elef shekel, afilu misofek. In other words, when I do something on your behalf, the question is, would you yourself have done what I did for you? In other words, I'm a third party. Yehuda's a third party. He took the initiative. As a result, Shimon took a loss of 1,000 shekel. There definitely was more than a logical possibility that under these circumstances, Reuven, in fact, did invite or would have invited Shimon to the wedding, as we saw in Rav Chaim Palagi, in order to save himself from Corona. Shimon, therefore, is in a position where it's worth it for him, given the logical possibility that by giving the 1,000 shekel as a wedding gift to Reuven, he could re-establish that friendship, he could completely dispel the machlokes, and as a result, save his life and reciprocally Reuven's life from this terrible magefa. Says Rav Zilberstein, although Groma bin Ezekin is Chaya b'din Shamayim, it's Chaya b'din Shamayim because you took the initiative on behalf of someone else's possessions, and that person did not take the initiative. For example, in the first case, did Shimon bury his money in the ground? He didn't do so. And there's no reason for us to conclude that he would have done so. Because whenever you bury money in the ground, and I can tell you this from my experience, whenever I put something away in order to protect it, and I hide it, there's at least a 20%, if not a 50% chance that I won't remember where I put it. I always say that's my vision of what Olam Haba is like, when you find all the things you lost during the course of your lifetime. Anyway, in the case of moving a kli from place to place, you took the initiative on behalf of someone else. Who says that he would have moved the kli? Maybe he would have realized that you're running a risk that it might break. But if we have a situation where we could prove, based on a Torah perspective, that so-and-so would have himself been agreeable to put his money into a dangerous possible situation of a suffix that he might lose it, but it's worth him to go into that suffix, because when we weigh the two sides of the scale, it's objectively worth the money or the sakana or the suffix, then in that case, if somebody does what he assumes another person would have done with his own money in order to save that person's life, even if it's only a suffix, then he's not even chayav bedin shamayim. And based on this logic, Rav Zilberstein comes to the conclusion that because of the corona epidemic, what Yehuda did, which indirectly caused Shimon to take a loss of 1,000 shekel by giving this gift to Reuven, and Shimon in fact wasn't invited to the wedding, that's something that even Bedin Shamayim is not called a hezek, because Shimon, even on the chance that the 1,000 shekel would bring a pacification between him and his former buddy Reuven, now his enemy, so to speak, it would be worth it for Shimon, in objective terms, to protect himself from machlokes, to invest the money And every investment, of course, entails a suffix. But when you have the possibility of protecting yourself from a magefa, it's worth it to spend every last penny that you have, even if only for a suffix. And therefore, he says that since it's a tzad gadol, shal yidei elef shekel, yesh shalom, that maybe the 1,000 shekel that Shimon gave as a gift to Reuven, logically it makes sense to anticipate the possibility, a very strong possibility, that it will create shalom bisman magefa, is kedayu la'odom le'safek hefse, to enter into a safek hefse situation by spending the 1,000 shekel. And therefore, although Shimon, it didn't occur to him that maybe Reuven would reconcile their relationship based on the gift, but once he got the invitation, then Shimon immediately jumped into action, and that's exactly what Yehuda was hoping. But again, Yehuda was banking on the fact that that gift would reconcile the relationship. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Maybe it'll happen down the line. We don't know. But this is all a very unique kind of ishtadlus about an initiative during a magefa period, where Reb Chaim Palagi writes that a ben das, anyone who has intelligence, would give up money of his own. He calls it yevater ben begufo ben bemamono, and it's worth it for him to spare himself from in olam hazeh and in olam haba. This leads us directly to the next question, and that's called Staka Tatzil Mimavis. And here again, during the corona period, somebody becomes very, very ill. His life is hovering between life and death. And in order to save himself, he takes upon himself a neder that if he will be healthy, he will give $500,000, which is basically his entire assets in the bank, to tzedakah, to be divided up amongst B'nai Torah. He gets a double mitzvah, the mitzvah of tzedakah, and also the mitzvah of being Mekayim Torah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu spared him from almost certain death, and Raphael, the great Malach Raphael, came, and B'siyata D'shmaya, he was restored to health. The first thing he does when he gets out of the hospital, he can stand on 2 feet, is he divvies up $500,000, basically the entire sum of his assets, to tzedakah. Now, did he do the right thing by taking this neder or not? The halacha is very complicated here. There is no yes or no answer to this question. The answer really is yes and no at the same time. Yes, he did the right thing. Tzedakah tatzil mimavis. There's a special mitzvah of tzedakah to save a person who's so deathly ill. But it's a violation of the halacha that was established by Holchei Usha, you know, the Sanhedrin, when it went into Golus, it landed in different places. One of the locations was Usha. And the Holchei Usha made a takana that a person does not give up more than 20% of his assets for any mitzvah, even for the mitzvah of tzedakah. Now, when the various institutions, the Torah institutions, receive these massive amount of monies, these checks, heavy, heavy, heavy checks. By the way, it says $500,000. It doesn't tell you whether it's a Canadian dollar, Australian dollar, an American dollar. This I don't know. But the institutions wanted to do the right thing. And when an institution gets a very, very substantial sum of money, that is 100 times, if not 1,000 times, the highest contribution they ever got in the history of that institution, they're required to do some research. Iron vintage wine of Rabbi Wine, Rabbi Beryl Wine, he has a beautiful story about a check that came to Shari Zion, which is a Syrian, a Sfaradi institution in Flatbush, and the Shaarei Zion people realized that this was a mistake, that he had sent it to a different yeshiva, which is Rabbi Wein's yeshiva at that time in Muncie, also called Shaarei Zion, and he sent it to the Sephardic Shaarei Zion on Ocean Parkway. Anyway, it's a beautiful story if you have access to the book Vintage Wine. In any event, the Talmidei Chachamim of different Torah institutions get on the phone to various poskim. The question comes in front of Rav Zilberstein, what should they do with this massive amount of money? And after doing some research, Rav Zilberstein finds out that this person who was so deathly ill from corona is now an Anisha Baniyim. He is standing online waiting to get handouts because he actually gave his last dollar to tzedakah. He is technically, according to Halacha, an Ani. Now, there's a problem here. Although the institutions are willing to give back the money, or at least part of the money, and that seems like the right thing to do, there's Halacha Nidrei Tzedakah, that once the money was given as a nether tzedakah, it has a chal shem, it's a status in the money, and that money has to be given for tzedakah. Otherwise, it's a problem in many different dimensions. It's gzela, and it's also me'ila and hegdesh. I mean, very different shilas about nidrei hegdesh. And nidrei tzedakah, to a large extent, have an upgraded status of nidrei hegdesh. So what should we do with the money? So Rav Zilberstein suggests the following dre, if you pardon the phrase, but I mean in a positive sense, don't misunderstand me. And he suggests that the money should be given to what's called the Kupat HaIr. Every city or every community has its own community chest, which is a tzedakah organization. And they will return the money to the original giver, the donor, because he's an Ani. So they have Kesef Mamon Tzedakah. On the one hand, the Noder has fulfilled his Neder, because he sent the money with all sincerity and it was received by the various institutions. So that's a fulfillment of tzedakah. On the other hand, and this entire tshuva of Rav Zilberstein is built on the following premise, which he tries to prove. When tzedakah money was given in a way that it shouldn't be given, then we have to return that money. However, we don't return it to its giver because of the problem of tzedakah, so we return it to the Kupas HaIr, in this case, the local community charity chest. On the one hand, the Noder who took the Neder fulfilled his Neder, and he was Zochet to the Malach Rafal, as we said before. And on the other hand, those institutions that received that money will have returned the money to its rightful place. And Rav Zilberstein raises what would be our natural objection to this psak. Why would we object to this psak? And the answer is because the kupas hatzdaka is also regulated by certain laws. And the halacha is that they have a certain sum of money that they give out to each ani. So let's say, for example, you are the gabai tzedakah for the kupas ha'ir, and your general, you know, gift is, shall we say, 500 shekel, or $500. So now you're giving back massive amount of money. How are you allowed to do that within the framework of the responsibility of the kupas ha'ir to give out tzedakah? So Zilberstein beautifully quotes a very radical and far-reaching principle in Hilchas Tzedakah, which is codified by the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Reish Nun, and that's called De Machsoro Shel Yechser Lo. Now, what is De Machsoro Shel Yechser Lo? The Gemara gives the example of a person who, in his good days financially, would ride a horse. He became poor. And a horse is a very expensive commodity, you know, let's call it a Rolls Royce. And the Balei Tzedaka, the Gabai Tzedaka, will have to give this person who became an Ani a horse. That's called De Machsor Shel Yeso, which basically means they have to bring him up to the level financially that he was used to. For example, if he has certain kalim, certain utensils that he uses in the house, then we have to give him those kalim. We can't give him the cheapest kalim. Or Darko Lirkov Alasus, Eved Roritz Lefanov, when he was wealthy, he had servants. That's what we have to do when he became, because psychologically, he cannot tolerate this new experience as in destitute. Here also, this person, before he gave this neder of $500,000, was used to a wealthy kind of lifestyle, and therefore it's within the purview of the tzedakah and the gabbai tzedakah in charge of the kupas ha'ir to present him with substantial sums of money. And in order to prove that this is what should happen, Rav Zilberstein quotes a very fascinating gemara at the end of Bava Basra. And there was a certain machlokes between Yonasan ben Uziel and Shammai HaZaken. And what happened was, there was a person who wanted to cut off one of his sons from his inheritance, because that son was not acting properly. It was Eino Noi Kishura. So what he did was, before it was too late, he got up and he wrote all his monies to Yonasan ben Uziel. And Yonasan ben Uziel took that money, divided up into three parts. Part of it he put back into the estate. Part of it he was magdish to Hegdesh, a kind of a tzedakah. And a third of it he gave to that child who was cut off from the inheritance. Now again, we would have to really learn the laws of inheritance, which is a fascinating topic. It's a perek in Bava Basra called Yesh Nochlin. And the law is that if you have a son who's not behaving the right way, you still cannot cut him off from Yerusha. Again, I'm not going into detail about that, because obviously those are difficult questions. And Shammai was upset with Yonasan ben Uziel, and part of the reason he was upset was because Yonasan ben Uziel was taking back money that could have been earmarked for Hegdesh, for Tzedakah. But Yonasan ben Uziel insisted that the halacha is that if money was given to Tzedakah when it shouldn't have been given to Tzedakah, then it should be returned so that it be earmarked for that which is meant to be earmarked. So that third of the man's possessions, which should have been earmarked for his son, the son who was not Noi Kishura, and instead it was earmarked for Tzedakah, Yonasan ben Uziel wanted to make sure that that money would be given to the inheritance, for the inheritance of that son that was cut out. Says Rav Zilberstein, you see very clearly that even money that is earmarked for Tzedakah and could be given to Tzedakah, nevertheless, if it was meant, according to the halacha, to be given in a different way, in this case, through the laws of inheritance, then we have to do whatever we can to get that money back. And since Yonasan ben Uziel was the recipient in charge of these monies, he's like the kupas ha'ir, therefore he took the money away from Tzedakah, and in this case he gave it to that son that should have it for his inheritance. And you'll see here, again, if you happen to have page 19, I try my best to send you the source material so that you can enjoy the text inside and underline certain very important lines. So on page 19, about, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines up from the bottom, which is the end of the last, next to the last paragraph, he writes, Hare, what we see is Hanhaga Ru'uya, the best way of going halachically, is that Tzedakah Tachzir Kesef, that the money should be returned. And that's what Yonasan ben Uziel did. He took money that was tzedakah money and he returned it to its rightful owner. And here too, that this donor, with all due respect, he should not have given away all his money in such a way that he's left without a penny. Therefore, the right way to do this is to make sure that the tzedakah money will be returned to him. Again, we don't want to upset the laws of Mamon Shel Tzedaka, the Nedri Tzedaka. And he says, therefore, two lines before the end of this page, Al HaMakablim, on those who receive that money, Mutav, there's a responsibility, Mutal Lidog Shakesef Yagir B'Chazara LaNosen. And that's the mitzvah that's incumbent upon the Gabbai Kupas HaTzedaka, that they should make sure that that money goes back to its rightful donor. Very interesting set of halachas, because if I were to wake you up in the middle of the night and ask you, in what situation do the makabel tzedakah, those who receive tzedakah money, have an obligation, according to the halacha, of returning the tzedakah money? And you might say, well, in a case where there was a mistake, and that's Rav Wein's case over there, where he sent the money to the wrong address, but in this case, he knew very well that he wanted to give that money. He had full intention. And that was tzedakah tatzil mimavis. And he feels that not only was he obligated to give this money, which saved his life, but he actually went ahead and gave that money. So you would have said, well, why would the makabel tzedakah have to return that money? But the answer is because of the takon of holchei yusha, that a person should never leave himself in a situation where he has nothing to give. And Rav Zilberstein concludes this presentation on page 20. In the third paragraph, he says, "Binyanenu me'achrav ha'kesef hazeh goram le'ha'ashir l'redis minachosav." Since this tzedakah money caused this person who was wealthy at one point to be a poor person, a pauper, tzarech l'shtamish v'kesef la'hamidos al raglayim, we have to use that money to make sure he gets back on his feet. And this is the most important matara, purpose, as far as the tzedakah money is concerned. The greatest agenda, or shall we say earmark the money, is to make sure that this giver, who gave much more than he should have given, should be reestablished financially on his feet. Now, if you take a look on page 21, by the way, if anybody wants to ask any questions now, if not, I'm shooting very heavy here, because I really wanted to cover a massive amount. I really want to finish our kuntres of Rav Zilberstein today. Here's a case of what's called maris ayin. A person is not allowed, according to halacha, to do an action in the eye of the public, which will be misinterpreted as if he was violating the Torah law. Now, what's going on during Corona, and I don't know if you see this where you are, but here I see it all the time, is that the B'nai Torah, the young yeshiva students, are studying Torah over the phone. It's fascinating how HaKadosh Baruch Hu was makdim refuah l'makah with all the technology, and the Rebbeim in various Chadorim, and now it's a little bit less because it's Bein HaZmanim, but this will be, this will start again very soon. They are giving shiurim over the phone. And people are walking around with telephones, you know, with what we call telephone nayad, meaning these various kinds of phones, and they are listening to shiurim. This particular yeshiva student asks Rav Zilberstein about Maris Ayin, what's called the Yisem Nekiyim. He is on his way to shul, and he's on the phone listening to a shiur, and there's a break between Mincha Mayriv. I used to remember Rav Weber's shiurim between Mincha Mayriv. I still have a lot of halachas that I remember for that. What was it, about 15 minutes between Mincha Mayriv? I still wash my hands twice every morning when I get up and go to the bathroom, because Rav Weber quoted Poskim that washing your hands inside the bathroom is not enough. By the way, I spoke to Rav Weber about it later. He says, no, you don't have to be machmir. But I took it upon myself. Anyway, so during this 15-minute break between Mincha Mayriv, he wants to continue listening to the shiur. But he's in the Beis HaKnesses. And he's asking Rav Zilberstein that the people around him think that he's listening to his telephone in a shul. Now again, in our experience, I don't know if it's such a terrible thing to answer a phone in shul, but this is not acceptable in certain circles. It's a pegia in kavod beis haknesses. it undermines the respect that we have to have for shul to be on the phone in the shul. But he's not there just to undermine the Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. He's listening to the phone because he has to hear the shiur. And the Mishnah in Masechta Shkolim says that Chayav Adam Lotzeis Yidei Brios HaBrios Kiderech Shetzorech Lotzeis Yidei HaMokom Shenemar V'yisem Nekiyim MeHashem Umi Yisrael Motzachein, etc., etc. To make a long story short, he's asking, should he not listen to the shiur because he's in shul and people will suspect that he is, they don't know that he's on the phone to hear a shiur. So Rav Zilberstein comes up with the following suggestion. He says, go over to the Sfarim Shank, every shul supposedly has an Arom Sfarim, take out any Sefer, Gemara, Chumash, put it down, open it up, and as you're listening to the shiur, peek into the Sefer, and people will understand that you're listening to Torah. Why are you on the phone with the Gemara in front of you, looking into the Gemara with your finger on the place? And then people will understand. But you might ask me, well, there's a principle called Midvar Sheker Tirchak, that it looks like you're really fabricating the truth, you're misleading people into thinking that you're learning from the Gemara. He says, name. That's not a serious chashash of what we call chashada. Chashada means that they'll suspect you. Why? Because, people have to understand that sometimes you read from the Gemara, sometimes you don't read from the Gemara. He says you want to be machmir, read a little bit from the Gemara, but he says there's no problem of sheker in this case. But he asks, what happens in a case where... Oh, so he says, yesh lahatir lahotzi sefer kolshu lahamid panim. Lahamid panim is a Hebrew phrase which means to show off as if you're learning from the sefer, which you're really not doing. He says, no problem. Ein b'kach mishum. He says, that's not fabrication and that's not called bizoyin ha-sefer. Maybe you're insulting the sefer because you're not really learning from it. He says, it's within the context of Libra Torah. I'm now on the top of page 22. And he quotes a Mishnah Bura that says that you're not allowed to use a sefer for your own personal benefits. Like, let's say, for example, some people will take a sefer and they'll put it over their head in the sun. That's a problem. Again, I'm not getting into the whole issue of printed svarim and the status thereof. But anyway, he says here he's not using the sefer for his own personal benefits to benefit from it. He's doing it for the sake of Talmud Torah. And then Rav Zilberstein closes this discussion by saying that if the Beis HaKnesses simply doesn't have any Sfarim, or maybe the Sfarim are locked up, or the library is closed for Corona, he says, nevertheless, he should respond to the phone, use the phone, and he should not worry about Chashada, because even though a person is obligated to fulfill the mitzvah of V'yisem Nekiyim, im eino yochol, if he cannot fulfill the mitzvah of V'yisem Nekiyim, al yimona, mi limud haTorah, kidei shaTorah lo tisbatel chalila. He says that if you weigh these two great ethical principles, on the one hand, the yisem nekiyim, that people will suspect you, and on the other hand, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, that we shouldn't be mevatel Torah, he says the mitzvah of being mevatel Torah outweighs, of not being mevatel Torah, outweighs by far the yisem nekiyim. Unfortunately, I was disappointed because I didn't see that he would quote any sources to prove this. But I could just guess, if I had to write the footnote, that the Gemara says Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam, and also in any case where you suspect someone, you have a responsibility of determining that person's chazaka. Does he have what's called a cheskas chaver? He has a young yeshiva bacha. Why is he on the phone in shul? It's your responsibility to figure it out. Now, based on the discussion that we had before about Grumma bin Azikin, Rav Zilberstein asks the following question. And this is on page 22. Reuven shows up. I'm sorry, I got the names wrong. Shimon shows up at Reuven's daughter's wedding. And when Reuven comes over to Shimon, he asks him immediately, because there's a very limited amount of guests at the wedding, he says to him, "How are you feeling?" Implying, "Do you have any symptoms?" And Reuven responds, "I feel fine." Reuven, therefore, participates in this great simcha. And guess what? As it turns out, Reuven had tested positive for corona. Now, he doesn't tell you the details here of the shaila. Did Reuven fool himself into thinking that he couldn't infect anyone? But in any event, as a result of Reuven participating in this wedding, somebody else contracts the disease. And the question is, again, you might have socialized medicine. He's not discussing those nitty-gritty details, but he says that there's something called Dmei Ripui. Right? There are five categories of compensation laws in the case of Adam Amazik. One of them is called Ripui, which means I have to pay your hospital bills, your doctor's bills. Not only that, the person, and again, he doesn't tell you how many people there are, but let's say there was one person who contracted the disease. He spent, even if he has socialized medicine, he spends money out of pocket to travel back and forth to the Beit Cholim. He also suffers other losses, financial losses. For example, he has to pay a heavy rental fee because he's in quarantine, and to rent a place for someone who's ill with corona, it's a very high amount of money. And again, the question here is, since Reuven, knowing full well that he had contracted the disease, he has caused all this loss to someone else, is he obligated in compensation? And again, Rav Zilberstein opens the tshuva by saying, this is Groma ben Ezekin, which we said is Chayav B'dini Adam. I'm sorry, is Potem B'dini Adam v'Chayav B'din Shamayim. In other words, Reuven didn't actually cause in a direct way any kind of a hezek. He did it indirectly. Again, I was wondering, what if he did it directly? Let's say if he was really angry at someone, he wanted to give him corona, would he have to pay for that? I don't know. But that's not the case that Rav Zilberstein is addressing. And guess what? It seems, I'm very unclear about all the details here, that as a result, Bino, the Chassan himself, contracted the disease. They had to be mevatel the Chassan. Again, it's very unclear. Maybe did this happen a week before the wedding? Again, you have to use your imagination to try to fill in the details. He doesn't tell you all the nitty-gritty details. As a result, they have to cancel the catering hall, and they have to cancel the band, and so forth and so on. So is there an obligation, at least b'dinei shamayim, for him to pay for this nezikin? And Rav Zilberstein says that for sure he's obligated to pay b'din shamayim. But on the bottom of page 22, nira od sheyesh dvarim sheshimon yechayv gam b'dinei adam. He wants to claim that there are certain payments that he's obligated to pay b'dinei adam. Kigon im esachsem titashlum b'diras echo me'atoshovim Az yesh liton shebetos kibel sadira kama ye adam muchan lahaskir di rosso lechole corona. And for the balance of this tshuva on page 23, he argues that in this case there would be possibly a chiyuv b'dinei adam. And he bases himself on another tshuva that he wrote. I'm looking at my watch. Let me give you the homework to go through that, but fast forward if you can to page 26. And this will be the last question in Rav Zilberstein that we want to address today, or maybe we'll fit in one more, but very quickly, because of the time consideration, he says that during the corona epidemic, there were very strict rules and decrees by the health department, and we have to be very careful about the spreading of this disease. And he speaks about the statistics of how many people got sick here in Israel and so forth and so on. And in one particular synagogue, they had two minyanim. They had a vasikin minyan. The average age of the vasikin minyan was above 70. There was a younger minyan that took place later on for people in the age of 30 and 35. He hints that they had a special kiddush after the minyan. I don't know how they got away with that, but you know, when it comes to a schnapps, you have to have a kiddush after davening, especially for the young people. I don't know if you know anything about that. And what happens is that the Misrad HaBriyut comes along with some very serious strictures about older people, because they have, as you know, a greater risk involved in terms of corona. And Yom Echad, in one particular minyan, it may have been the Vasika minyan, I'm not sure, there's a Rofe Bachir, a very outstanding physician, and he shows up at the minyan, and he notices that there are people in the minyan that he happens to, from his personal involvement in their health, because he's the physician, or because he's physician, he has access to other physicians and he knows things that people don't know. He realizes that there are a number of people, he seems to assume it's quite a few people, who showed up for davening, and they belong, because of their various ailments and their diseases, to a very high risk category, a profile, and they should not be coming to the minyan. Now, there's a gabbai for the corona minyan in that base Knesset. He has the authority and the responsibility to guarantee that all the rules are upheld. But he doesn't have access to this information that the rofe has information. And now the rofe himself has to decide, should he go over to this mispalel and ask him to leave the base Knesset? Or at least, at the very least, to tell him not to come another time. In certain cases, this would violate, what's the word? It starts with a C. In Hebrew, it's called sodiyut harefu'ah. Can anybody help me with that? When you have a client, confidentiality. How do you like that? I probably haven't heard that word in 10 years. Anyway, it would violate the etiquette of confidentiality if he would go over to someone and say, well, I know that you suffer from this disease or that disease. Not only that, it's going to embarrass him, because people are going to realize that he got up and he walked out, or he didn't come the next week because he suffers from certain disease. And this is a medical history that other people are not aware of. And he feels that, this Rofe feels that if he goes over to the Gaboyim and reveals to them that so-and-so has this medical disease, then he'll be really defying the laws of confidentiality. It's being pogea in the pratiyut, secrecy, or whatever the word is, the privacy of a person. On the other hand, if he doesn't do anything, then it could be that he is now participating in endangering someone's life. Not actively participating, but that person might actually be in a life-threatening situation because of this terrible infectious disease. What should the Rofe do? And quoting, again, I'm just trying to juggle the time that we have. So I'm going to make this really short again. It's on the bottom of page 26. He quotes a Gemara in Sanhedrin about Rebbe. The Gemara tells about Rebbe that he sat in the Beis Medrash and he was darshaning and he smelled garlic from one of the students. And he made a public declaration. He said, the one who ate garlic today should stand up and walk out. Do you remember this Gemara? Reb Chiya stood up and he walked out. And every last student stood up and walked out. The next morning, Rebbe meets Rebbe Chiya. And he says to him, you caused me a tremendous amount of suffering because you stood up and walked out and all the Talmidim walked out. Ata shetziartos Rebbe. Omar lo, Reb Chiya responds, and he says, lo tehei kazos b'Yisrael. This will not be acceptable process. There's a very severe Iser Bittul Torah, it's a terrible sin, but to be mevayish a person publicly, ein lecha avera gedola m'Yisrael, that we have to be mevatel Torah rather than embarrass someone, humiliate him publicly. And therefore, if you force one person to stand up and walk out of shir, walk out of the classroom, that is humiliating him publicly. So it means that even though the person who ate the garlic and entered into the Beis Medrash, he violated his laws of etiquette, but nevertheless, we're not allowed to humiliate him publicly and ask him to go out. And that's a terrible issue. And kedai levatel haTorah kedei shelo yivayish odem miYisrael. And at the end of this tshuva, on the bottom of page 26, gam b'sheilosenu, ra'ui shekama anoshim shemutol em lavo lebeis haKnesset ki hem lo chashu sakana yetzu vayidei zeh lo yisbayshu osam zkenim hanimtzoim bekvusat sikun. He says the following, that in order not to embarrass publicly those elders who came and violated the rules because they were not supposed to be in the shul, other people who don't have this history should likewise stand up and walk out of the shul. Now, I know that our time has passed. If anyone here has 5 minutes to stay on...
One second.
Yes. Again, you know, it goes on and on. If you take a look on page 27...
There's not a sakana to anybody by smelling the garlic.
And yet, it was wrong of his on his part to come into the Beis HaKnesses and interrupt the shir by having this smell. It's not proper to have a bad odor when you come into a crowded Beis HaKnesses, Beis HaMedrash. But nevertheless, although he violated some of the laws of etiquette, we're not going to humiliate the person. So that we have to do whatever we can to achieve our goal, and that is to make sure that that he leaves, but without doing it in a way that'll humiliate him. So Rav Zilberstein suggests that we get a group of people together, I don't know, he doesn't tell you exactly how you orchestrate this, and get them all to leave, so that when this person leaves, no one will know that he was the one who was singled out. That's how he suggests that we achieve it. Now, if that possibility doesn't exist, I can't tell you what Rav Zilberstein would say. My impression would be that under those circumstances, he would have to find a way of convincing that person, if he can, maybe he should contact the other physicians, that he shouldn't show up in the synagogue, but not to embarrass him publicly and not to violate the laws of conventionality. Again, Joe, just if you don't mind, hold your question for 5 minutes, if you can. I don't know if you have to run. But just this tshuva Rav Shechter. Rav Shechter wants to know, what's going to be on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? You have two minyanim, the earlier minyan and the later minyan. And you don't find the best choice for a shatz, for a shliach tzim, for the second minyan. The best choice is the shatz who served the first minyan. Now, there are two questions that he addresses. First, can that shatz, who served in that capacity in the first minyan, duplicate, so to speak, and a second time around serve as a shliach tzibur in the second minyan to satisfy the needs of the second minyan? And secondly, if he's a shatz for the second minyan as well as the first minyan, he already davened what's called the tefillah belachash in the first minyan. Does he repeat tefillah belachash? And for that matter, let's say he starts at Hamelech, right? Hamelech, right? And he's going to recite brachos, Berachas Kriyat Shema, Baruch Hu, he doesn't mention Baruch Hu, and so forth and so on, Gal Yisrael, in order to serve as a shatz. Now, honestly, you know, I always have to put in my two cents. I don't understand the shaila at all. I don't know why Rav Shechter had to take his time to write a two-page tshuva, which you may have gotten, thanks to David Spiegel, in your email. To me, in my mind, you would have to convince me that there was a hava mina that he couldn't serve as a shatz for a second minyan. That itself is an untenable position. Why can't he serve as a shatz for the second minyan? In fact, I would say he's obligated to serve as a shatz for the second minyan. And I once wrote an article in a journal called Tchumin. And in that journal, I quoted a famous tshuva, the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer wants to know, the Torah says, Kosev Archus B'nei Yisrael. And what happens if a Kohen blessed a tzibur, and then a second tzibur gathers together for another minyan, and they want the same Kohen, they don't have another Kohen, to recite Birchas Kohen. So the Chassam Sofer points out that in addition to his responsibility on a personal level, it's called the Chovas Gavra, of Kosev Archos B'nei Yisrael, he also has an obligation to facilitate the bracha on behalf of the tzibur. The tzibur has to be misbarech, they have to be blessed, and they need to find a Kohen. So he'll recite the bracha of Birchas Kohenim with Hasher Kitshonim Mitzosu V'tzivanu a second time. And the same thing is true here in this case. I mean, it's very nice that he has davened his own personal davening. He served as a shatz in the first minyan. But now we have another tzibur. They need a shliach tzibur. He can serve in that capacity. He's obligated to do so. I don't know why Rav Shechter has to write a whole tshuva about that. If Rav Shechter wanted to point out that he does not repeat his tefillah belachash, which he already recited, once again, to me that's a dover pashut. You fulfilled your own personal chovas gavra, and you davened once, why would you daven a second time? But as far as the tefillah of the tzibur, which is called Chazoras HaShatz, again, initially, Chazoras HaShatz was not really an institution. It was only a way of guaranteeing that even those, they didn't have printed sidurim, even those who couldn't daven, they would hear the Shliach Tzibur and Biyotze through Shomei Ka'ona. But that's just at the very fledgling state. Now we have a separate takana of Tfilas HaTzibur, and that's a new entity that the Tzibur gathers together for one unified Tfilah, in addition to the individual prayers that each one recited Belachash. And to repeat your Tfilah Belachash is, first of all, unnecessary if you want to serve as a shatz for the second minyan. You already fulfilled your obligation in the first round. And secondly, it's prohibited. It's not only unnecessary, it's prohibited. And you might say, well, let him daven a tefilas nedava or something like that, but there's no tefilas nedava on Yontif. So, after reading through the tshuva very carefully to try to figure out what was going through Rav Shechter's mind that he had to write this tshuva, I figured out that he had in mind a Mishnah Brura. The Mishnah Brura seems to assume that if a person comes in after the tefillah belachash is already well on the way, and now he wants to serve as the shatz to repeat Shmoneh Esrei, then the Mishnah Brura has a certain hesitation. I wouldn't say that he prohibits it. He's a little inhibited about it, because since he didn't recite the tefillah b'yachid, the tefillah lachash, then, like, mi samcha, why are you coming to daven, you know, the Chazor Sashatz? You know, you were never part of the Tzibur. You're a foreign element, and now you're jumping into the ring to recite the Tfilas Chazor Sashatz. So the Mishnah Brura says, if possible, we should find someone amongst the 10 people who recited the Tfilas Lachash and have him repeat the Chazoras HaShatz. If in the absence of that possibility, then Ene Chinami, someone who is not part of the minyan and didn't daven his tefillah b'lachash. I think also the Mishnah Berurah, by the way, might be inhibited because of a principle called Ein Osim Chavilos Chavilos, which means that what it looks like when this Reuven comes in and he davens Chazoras HaShatz, he fulfills two chiyuvim with one maisa. In other words, he does two mitzvahs. He knocks off two birds with one stone. He'll fulfill his own tefillas lachash. He will not daven a second Shmona Esrei. And he has served as the shliach of the tzibur to pray the Chazoras HaShatz. So it looks a little bit like he's pottering up two chiyuvim with one action. That's called chavilos chavilos. We try not to piggyback one mitzvah on top of another. But again, none of that is relevant to our discussion here about a shliach tzibur on Rosh Hashanah who wants to serve on a second round as a shliach tzibur for a second minyan. There's no chavilos chavilos here. The tzibur needs him, and therefore he should comply with the tefillas hatzibur. Now, Rav Shecht assumes at the bottom of this tshuva, if you happen to have it, in the last three lines, that this shliach tzibur has already fulfilled his obligation in the first round, the first minyan, should not recite birchas kriyat shema a second time around. And I'm not exactly sure why that's so. He quotes a Birkei Yosef, but he doesn't tell you exactly where this Birkei Yosef is. The Birkei Yosef was written by the Chidah. And I'm not sure if that Birkei Yosef, it's unclear in the way this tshuva is written, whether or not that has any relevance to this. Rav Shechta says, V'kai gavnash also shatz chozer al shachris bebeiz minyanim. So he has already served as the shliach tzibur for shachris in the first minyan. And now they need him to serve as a shatz in the second minyan. Then he should begin his service, so to speak, as shatz after birchas kriyat shema. And he should certainly not repeat birchas kriyat shema, kevan, shashatz hazekvar hispalel on the last line of the tshuva, hispal kvar shachris b'minyan hashkoma, and therefore rak yachzor al tefilas hamido b'kol ram. He should only repeat the Chazor Sashatz out loud on behalf of the second minyan, but he should not be reciting Birchas Krishma. I'm not exactly sure why that's so. And I admit that with all this these tshuvas from Rav Zilberstein, which is a lot of work, I hope you appreciate that what we accomplished here. Again, Joe, you still have some questions, but we'll see if I can answer them or not. But what I have to tell you is that there's a sugya in Megillah, Daf Chav Gimel, and it appears in Brachos as well, called Poreis Al Hashma. And Poreis Al Hashma means that Chazoras HaShatz begins with Birchas Kriyat Shema. Meaning that Birchas Kriyat Shema is not just a Chovas Yachid, but there is an element of Tzibur in Birchas Kriyat Shema. So that if all things are equal and you have two options, you could either, read your own Berchas Kriyat Shema and then come into the shul and hear the Chazor Sashatz, daven with the Tzibur Shmon Esrei, or you could be there in shul for the Berchas Kriyat Shema. I think the law is, and I have to check this out to see if I remember correctly, that you should be there for Berchas Kriyat Shema. You should answer to Kadosh. There's a Kedusha. There we have three Kedushos that we say during the course of Shachris. And the first of those three kedushos is embedded in the very fabric of Birchas Kriyat Shema. And I think that there's a kiyum tzibur in both Kriyat Shema and in Birchas Kriyat Shema. And if, for the sake of the tzibur, the shatz is allowed to recite a second time around Chazoras HaShatz, that might be expanded, and the scope could include even Birchas Kriyat Shema. So I don't know, that's just a ha'ara on my part. Okay, Rabosai, we more than exhausted our time. If anyone has any questions, this would be a great opportunity. Joe, I'm looking back on page 26, which is the question of a person who, because of this magefa of corona, should not really come to shul, and he showed up in shul. And I thought that he would go into more detail about it on page 27, but now I'm looking here at the pages, and on page 27, he seems to go on to a different Shaila. So that he addresses this question of the Rofe that we discussed earlier only on page 26. And all he tells you, again, the facts on the ground are a little bit sketchy. The only thing he tells you here is that we should avoid humiliating a person publicly at all costs. As far as his Shaila originally, what should the Rofe do in this case? Again, you know, he's saying that other people should get up and walk out of the shul, and therefore there won't be any humiliation. He doesn't go into detail here. I have a feeling that what we're seeing here in these printed pages is a partial address. You know, he only partially addresses this, which might mean a few things. Either we're missing part of the tshuva, or it means that Rav Zilberstein is still mulling this over, trying to come to some final determination about what the Rofe should do in this case. He seems to assume that two things he certainly should not do. Number one is to violate the confidentiality. If he happens to be privy to information about a person's history, that he should, his medical history, he should not be revealing that publicly. And secondly, under all circumstances, he's got to avoid public humiliation. That's the impression you get over here, because all that Rav Zilberstein says here as a final tshuva is that other people, others came him in that minyan, who also somehow understand that there's someone there who shouldn't be there, they should be getting up and leaving the minyan in a way like the case of the garlic, that we should circumvent the embarrassment, the humiliation of that person who really has to get up. Maybe in that case, Rav Zilberstein will direct the Rofe towards that person and make sure that that person that he knows that has a history and shouldn't be there in the shul should get up and join the others kadim who are leaving the shul. I mean, again, I'm reading between the lines here. I'm just pointing out that I think my impression is that he didn't really come to any conclusion. Because I said to you before, Joe, when you asked this question, that maybe the answer is on page 27, and then I realized that we're pressed to finish the shiur, and I looked on page 27, and lo and behold, I didn't realize that there's no answer on page 27. He goes on to a different shiloh. So I can't write a text that's not there. Okay, then. So this is where we'll stop. And once again, thank you very much.